Probably to this day, it was the smartest joke I've ever made. I thought about how I'd had to beg the producers to let me no longer speak like Chandler for the final few seasons, not to mention getting rid of those sweater vests. This particular cadence, could it be more annoying? Had been so played out that if I had to put the emphasis in the wrong place one more time, I thought I would explode. So, I just went back to saying lines normally, for the most part in season 6 and then beyond. I thought about me crying when I asked Monica to marry me. And me being me, there were negative thoughts too. What will become of me now that I no longer have this insanely fun, creative job to go to every day? Friends had been a safe place, a touchstone of calm for me. It had given me a reason to get out of bed every morning. And it had also given me a reason to take it just a little easier the night before. It was the time of our lives. It was like we got some new piece of amazing news every day. Even I knew only a madman, which in many moments I had been nonetheless, would screw up a job like that. As we drove home that night along Sunset, I pointed out to Rachel a massive billboard promoting the whole 10 yards. There I was, 50 feet high, frowning in a dark suit and a purple shirt and tie, standing next to Bruce Willis. He dressed in a white t-shirt, pinafore, and bunny slippers. Willis. Perry. It read in 6-foot letters. Above the tagline, they missed each other. This time, their aim is better. I was a movie star. You remember what I said about the donkey's head, right? My future, even without friends, looked rosy enough, though. I had a major movie coming out, I'd done 2 episodes of Ally McBeal, and 3 of The West Wing. So I was developing serious acting chops as well as the comedy stuff. I'd gotten 2 Emmy nominations for the 3 West Wing appearances. I'd also just finished wrapping a TNT movie called The Ron Clark Story, about a real-life small-town teacher who gets a job in one of the toughest schools in Harlem. There wasn't a single joke in the whole thing. It drove me crazy, how serious it was. So off-camera, I created a character called Ron Dark, who was drunk and constantly swore in front of the children. Despite that, it was a big hit when eventually it aired in August 2006. I would garner nominations for a SAG Award, a Golden Globe, and an Emmy. I lost all 3 to Robert Duvall. I couldn't believe it, being beat out by such a hack. But, as I've said, the whole 10 yards would prove to be a disaster. I'm not sure even my closest family and friends went to see it. In fact, if you look closely enough, you could see people averting their eyes from the screen at the premiere. I think it actually got a 0 rating on Rotten Tomatoes. And that was the moment Hollywood decided to no longer invite Mr. Perry to be in movies. I had made arrangements to attend a 12-step meeting the day after the final taping of Friends, with the express intent of starting my new life on the right path. But facing the blank canvas of an empty day was very hard on me. The next morning I woke up and thought, what the fuck am I going to do now? What the fuck could I do? I was hooked on Bupe with no new job in sight, which was ridiculous given that I'd just finished making the most beloved sitcom in TV history. On top of that, my relationship with Rachel was getting rocky. The physical distance was an issue, as was the emotional closeness. I was damned if I did, damned when I didn't. And then I once again was single. With no ridiculously high-paying, dream-come-true kind of job to go to, and no special someone in my life, things slipped fast. In fact, it was like falling off a cliff. The insanity of using other, stronger drugs crept into my diseased brain once again. It wasn't long before the seemingly impossible happened again. I started drinking and using. Despite how it may appear, I was never suicidal, thank God. I never actually wanted to die. In fact, in the back of my mind, I always had some semblance of hope. But if dying was a consequence of getting to take the quantity of drugs I needed, then death was something I was going to have to accept. That's how skewed my thinking had become. I was able to hold those two things in my mind at the same time. I don't want to die, but if I have to, in order to get sufficient drugs on board, then amen to oblivion. I can distinctly remember holding pills in my hand and thinking this could kill me, and taking them anyway. This is a very fine and very scary line. I had reached a point in my drinking and using where I was drinking and using just to forget about how much I was drinking and using. And it took an almost lethal amount to accomplish that kind of amnesia. I was also so lonely that it hurt. I could feel the loneliness in my bones. On the outside, I looked like the luckiest man alive, so there were very few people I could complain to without being told to shut up, and even then, nothing could fill the hole inside me. At one point, I bought yet another new car, the excitement of which lasted about 5 days. I moved regularly, too. The thrill of a new house with an even better view lasted a bit longer than the Porsche or the Bentley, but not by much. I was also so introspective that a proper give-and-take relationship with a woman was nigh on impossible. I was much better at friends with benefits, so that whoever I was seeing didn't discover that slow, creeping thought that I was irredeemably not enough. I was lost. There was nowhere to turn. Everywhere I tried to hide, there I was. Alcoholics hate two things: the way things are, and change. I knew something had to change. I wasn't suicidal, but I was dying. But I was too scared to do anything about it. I was a man in need of a yellow light experience, so I was eternally grateful that it had happened that day in my house, because it gave me a new lease on life. I'd been given the gift of sobriety one more time. The only question was, what was I going to do with it? Nothing had worked long-term before. I was going to have to approach everything differently, or I was a goner. And I didn't want to be a goner. Not before I learned to live, to love. Not before the world made more sense to me. Had my habit killed me, it would have killed the wrong person. I wasn't fully me yet. I was just parts of me, and not the best parts either. My new approach to life would have to start with work, because that seemed to be the easiest place to start. Embracing effort was the only hope for me. I built up some sober time, was back on my feet once again. I also had a few friends with benefits things going on, but one was starting to slowly morph into something more, maybe much more. I knew how to do friends with benefits, but this I was less clear about. I started to want her to stay past the sex. Why don't you stick around and we can watch a movie? What was I doing? I was breaking all the rules. She was 23 and I was 36 when we first met. In fact, I knew she was 23 because I had crashed her 23rd birthday party. Our subsequent initial makeout session was in the back of a really messy Toyota. To think I'd spent all that money on fancy cars, and here I was in the back seat of a tan Corolla. When we were done, I said, I'm getting out of the car now, mostly because I'm 36. So began 2 years of probably record-breaking amounts of sexual intercourse. With no strings attached, both of us following the friends with benefits rules to a T. We were on the same page. We never went to dinner. We never talked about each other's families. We never discussed what went on in each other's lives regarding other people. Instead, it was texting and saying things like, how about Thursday night at 7? She was tough at first. I remember an exchange early on where I told her I was wearing a suit and that I thought I looked pretty good. I hate suits, she said. I broke her out of this toughness, but it took years. Somewhere it is written in the actor's handbook. Actually, it's probably in the book my dad gave me, the one inscribed with Another Generation Shot to Hell, that you have to try to do new things and stretch yourself. If you've excelled at comedy, then it behooves you to make a direct right turn and become a dramatic actor. So that became my plan. I couldn't retire, and there was only so much time a grown man could spend playing video games. As my friends with benefits partners said to me one day, "You live the life of someone who drinks and uses. You just don't drink and use." She was really smart, too. Did I mention that? I was at a crossroads. What do you do when you're an actor and you're rich and famous, but you're not interested in being rich and famous? Well, you either retire, way too young for that, or you change it up. I informed my manager and agents that I was now looking only for dramatic work. I had dabbled in it with good results on The West Wing and Ally McBeal and The Ron Clark Story, so it didn't seem like a crazy move. I auditioned for some serious films, but I didn't get any of them. I shot a few indie movies that tried hard, but that didn't work out either. Then, a script came along that was white hot. I had never seen so much heat attached to a project. It was magnetic. Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip, written by Aaron Sorkin and directed by Thomas Schlamme, was the follow-up to their little show called The West Wing. Between them, they had like 15 Emmys. So their new project caused a frenzy in the fall of 2005, unlike anything else. I had never seen a project that had so much power behind it before it had even started. NBC and CBS went at it like gladiators to get that thing, with NBC ultimately winning out to the tune of something like $3 million per episode. All that fall, wherever I turned, someone was talking about Studio 7 on the Sunset Strip, its original name. I was in New York finishing up the Ron Clark Story and staying at my favorite hotel in the world, the Greenwich in Tribeca. I really wanted to read this hot script. Because I was on the East Coast, the script would not get to my hotel until 10 p.m., so I waited up. Aaron and Tommy had changed the way America looked at serialized TV with The West Wing, and I had changed how America spoke English via the cadences of Chandler Bing. Seemed like a potent combination. By 11:30 p.m., I had read the script and decided to return to network television. The lead characters were Matt Albee, the head writer of Studio 7, and a role apparently Aaron had written with me in mind, and Danny Tripp, his fellow showrunner, to be played by the kind and brilliant Bradley Whitford, both being brought back to save an SNL-like show called Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip. Before a lick of it was filmed, it had giant Emmy-winning hit written all over it. It had Sorkin, Schlamme, and me. What could possibly go wrong? The first problem was the money. I'd been making a tremendous nut on Friends and realized I'd struggle to get that number again. But even so, the fact that everyone in this ensemble show about a comedy TV program was being asked to take the same fee. The conversation went something like this. Think of this in Sorkin speech. Me. I really want to do this. Manager. Well, no one does this kind of thing better than Sorkin. Me. This would be my return to television. It's the way to go. Manager. The only problem is the offer. Me. The offer? What is it? Manager. The offer is what you get per episode. Me. Yeah, I know that. Thank you. I meant, what's the number? Manager. $50,000 per episode. Me. I got more than $1 million per for Friends. Can't we get them up? Manager. It doesn't look like it. They want this to be a true ensemble show. That's why they're offering that to everyone. Me. I can't believe I have to turn down the best television script I've ever read. My manager, God bless him, didn't give up. He pointed out to the producers that even though Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip had indeed been conceived as an ensemble show, as soon as I stepped on stage, it was going to be about my character, which is what ended up happening. With that argument in mind, after about 6 weeks of negotiations, we got them off their ensemble idea. I was to be billed as the star of the show, and we got them up to $175,000. Now, obviously, that is an amazing amount of money to be paid a week, But three stages down, LeBlanc was being paid $600,000 a week to do Joey. But in the end, the writing prevailed. Every actor is just looking for good material. And I accepted the lowball number, and they hired my good friend Amanda Peet to round out the cast. We shot the pilot, and I would hold up that pilot against any pilot I've ever seen. It was that good. There was an energy to it, a crackle that's rare in TV, and fans loved it too. It opened huge. All my shows after Friends opened huge, and then suddenly, they weren't anymore. The second episode of Studio 60 drew literally half the number of people that the first one did. No one cared about the show. It took me years to figure out why. There was a fatal flaw to Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip, one that no amount of good writing or direction or acting could fix. On the West Wing, the stakes were as high as you can imagine. A nuclear bomb is pointing at Ohio, and the president has to fix that shit. People in Ohio would tune in to a show like that just to find out exactly what might happen if they were invited to kiss their asses goodbye by an incoming intercontinental ballistic missile. A very small group of people, myself included, know that for a sector of show business, getting a joke right is a matter of life and death. These are bent, weird people. But people in Canton, Ohio, watching Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip probably thought, "It's just a joke. Why doesn't everybody calm down? It's not that big a deal. What is wrong with all you people?" This was not the Monty Python bit about Ernest Scribbler, who wrote a joke so funny it killed the Nazis. The Brits are immune to its power because they don't speak German. And the actual German of the killer joke is gibberish, which is also funny. There might have been a devoted set of viewers in Rock Center or working the door of the Comedy Store on Sunset. But outside of that, the basic premise of the show didn't reach the levels of edge-of-the-seat stakes. Trying to attach the West Wing stakes to a comedy show could never work. On a granular level, I also found the Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip work environment to be frustratingly unlike that of Friends, or even the whole nine yards. Aaron runs a very tight ship. That's just how he likes it. To the point where there was someone on the set with a script making sure that if the original reads "he is angry" and I or someone else shortened it to "he's angry," we'd have to reshoot the entire scene. It had to be done exactly as written. I nicknamed the production assistant whose job it was the Hawk. And honestly, what a horrible gig she had, having to be a hall monitor to a bunch of creative types acting their balls off. Unfortunately, sometimes a take with a slightly different rendering of the line had been the best take of all, but still, the one that got used was the word perfect one, not the best one. The Aaron Sorkin as writer, Tommy Schlamme as director system was never really actor-centered. Therefore, it was much more about getting the text right, as though it was Shakespeare. In fact, I heard someone say on the set that this was Shakespeare. I also had a different view of the creative process generally. I was used to pitching ideas, but Aaron didn't take any of them. I had thoughts, too, about the arc of my character, but they weren't welcomed either. Problem is, I'm not just a talking head. I have a brain, especially comedically. Aaron Sorkin is a much better writer than I am. But he's not a funnier man than me. He'd kindly once said that Friends was his favorite show. And in Studio 60, I was playing a comedy writer. I thought I had some funny ideas, and Aaron said no to 100% of them. That's his right, and it's no knock on him that he likes to run his set his way. It just left me disappointed. Tom Hanks told me that Aaron did the same thing to him. I guess I was lucky that I'd already learned being on a successful TV show didn't fix anything. The show went out of the gate gangbusters, the pilot pulling down a cool 13 million viewers, and a 14 share, which was solid. The reviews were positive, too. Variety said, "It's hard not to root for Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip, a series that weds Aaron Sorkin's crackling dialogue and willingness to tackle big ideas with a beyond stellar cast. The Chicago Tribune went even further, writing me a love letter and saying Studio 60 is not just good, it has the potential to be a small screen classic. But the problem remained. It was trying to be a serious show about comedy and quality TV, as though those two things were as important as world politics. I recently read one really instructive critique about Studio 60 on the